Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Everywhere we go, people want to know who we are and where we come from. So who are you and where'd you come from?
Paloma Lynch, and I'm from Pear Street.
And Paloma, you're actually originally from Coolock.
I am, yeah.
And we know each other a very long time.
We do, Rebecca.
And it's mad because even though you're from Coolock and I'm from Coolock, it wasn't there that we became really close.
No.
It was across the Mediterranean in Cyprus that you came properly into my life.
Yeah.
And I just, like I said to Paul, yesterday I said, look, I reached out to Paloma, and he said to me, oh really? He said, how is she? And I was like, Paul, you've no idea. And as I said to you, when I seen your Instagram post, I got very upset when I seen you earlier on as well, because I just always wanted you just to be happy and to be strong in your life. That's all I wanted for you. And when I let you go, you flew home from Cyprus that time in your beautiful dress and everything. You looked like a goddess flying away. And I cried because I was so worried about you. And I just wanted to make sure that you were okay.
Yeah. And I remember, as I said to you back then, Rebecca, you know, as I said, I had just come out of prison and I didn't know what was wrong with me. You know, I thought Dublin was the problem. I thought where I lived was the problem. And I didn't know that the problem was deep within, you know. And when I went to Cyprus, I was running from myself, you know. I was trying to fill that void, as I always talk about, you know. And as you know, when I got over to Cyprus, and the reason that you sort of had to put me back on the plane was because, you know, like all of that madness just followed me and I didn't know why. Like, I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I didn't know I was an addict. I didn't know. And I was really vulnerable. I'm really lost, like, you know, really, really lost. And, you know, I was just always searching for something that would fix me and something that would, you know, like, take it away, you know, because I just thought, like, if I meet the right man, or if I go to the right place, or if I just get this job, like, it'll go. And none of it ever worked, like, nothing worked, no matter what I done, you know.
And before we get into that, because we'll talk about our time together in Cyprus, because I really enjoyed our time together. Talk to me about growing up in Coolock. What was that like? And then you said about prison. So can we have a little conversation about that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as I said to you, Rebecca, you know, like the family that I grew up in, like my mother had like four kids, and then she had this 8-year gap because my brother had been in an accident, and she had this 8-year gap, and we were like change of life babies. You know, she was kind of like coming into her 40s, and she got pregnant with me, and then a month later I was only a month old and she was pregnant with Janine, you know. And they all say in the family, you know, I was just wild, like I was just crazy. And Janine was lovely, like she was a real good kid and everyone would mind her. And I don't think I was allowed, there was loads of kids and all on the road that weren't allowed to play with me. I was always, you know, I used to sit on the end of the stairs shouting obscenities into the sitting room to them and no one cursed in the house, like it was real. And they just didn't know where they got me, and I was always running away. I was always telling them that I didn't belong there, and I never, as I said to you, felt a part of anything, whether it was me family, whether it was, you know, cousins, anything like that, you know. I never really felt a part of anything. And like, I always speak when I'm talking in like you know, the rooms, which is like, you know, a 12-step fellowship, I'll always speak about, you know, that internal kind of hole in my soul, you know, that, you know, I never, ever felt a part of, and I always felt less than, you know. And it, you know, I often say as well, you know, I feel like I was born with it. Now, a lot of people will say you can't be born with an addiction, like you can. And there's a lot of people, you know, that would often cross-share me when I say that. But I genuinely remember from the age of 3, because I looked back on a photo in these Dungreens. I remember, as I said to you, sitting on the end of the road in Coolock, looking down at me belly, thinking I was fat and ugly, and I was afraid, like, you know. And Janine had the air of a supermodel. Like, she just glided through life, and I couldn't cope. Like, I would be rocking back and forward from the age of 4, just wondering, how am I going to do it? You know, I didn't have those life skills that normal people have, you know, that kind of a way. And I always kind of knew, and I always felt that there was something wrong with me. Did you know? Yeah. Yeah.
And you know what? The thing was, like, as I said, I knew of you. And the reason I knew of you in Coolock was your beauty. Like, you know, I knew of you because of your beauty. I'd see you when I was walking to Clostradulich. I'd see you and I'd be like, she's gorgeous. Do you know what I mean? And that's what I knew of you. And even then, as I said, when I took her to Cyprus and how we became close there. And I was just so in love with you because you were just so kind. You were so soft. You were so nice. And then you're absolutely gorgeous, but you never saw that.
No, never, never. And like, me ma's from Sheriff Street, and all of her cousins and our, they all used to be in the house. And, you know, they'd be saying to me, and me ma'd be saying, she's no confidence. She doesn't see what we see and stuff like that. And I never, ever did. You know, I always felt, I don't know what it was. I don't know whether it was like, it wasn't even like insecurity. It was, I just seen something totally different than everybody else seen. I never, ever seen anything beautiful, you know, that way. I never seen that, you know.
So sad.
Yeah, it really is. It really is.
And at what point then, what was your first addiction? And at what point did you realise that you had an addiction?
Yeah. So, I will just breeze into this because I remember me poor ma, like, you know, because she was a lot older and she'd never been through this before. And I remember when I got really wild and I was going really heavy into, so it would have started like with God. But I remember, Rebecca, I do say, I think there was some sort of ADD there, you know, definitely there was, because I remember lying in my bed in the night and I'd be begging myself nearly not to get out of bed, and there was the compulsion, like that the pull was like magnetic. It was not normal. And next thing I know, I'd be going through the field in Coolock and I'd be down at Tiffany's on my own, going in and taking ease and stuff like that. And I was only 14. Like, I was only 14 when I was doing all this, and I was just wild. I was driven, like, you know, really driven, and it wasn't normal. Like, it really, when I look back on it now, and I look at, you know, young girls and stuff, you know, even where I live, and I look and I say, do you know how kind of stable that they are, even although they're a little bit kind of crazy and that, but there was something amiss there, you know. And it was on one of those mad nights that I got out of bed and I went down to Tiffany's that something really traumatic happened to me. And I remember it was very shortly after that that I started taking heroin. And I do always firmly believe that, you know, I remember the first time when I took it, you know, all of that stuff left me. I remember just closing my eyes and going, I couldn't wait to do it again. You know, that kind of a, like, and I just it was my first thing of addiction was heroin, definitely, you know, wanting to do it over and over again to take that away the way it took that away, because I just forgot about it all for that time, you know. I just felt, and I felt a part of something.
Did you?
For the first time in my life, I probably felt a part of something, you know. So that was the first thing of addiction. Yeah.
And how long did that go on for?
that went on until I hit prison, Rebecca, you know. And so I was 14 years of age when I first took it. And by the age of 15, I had met this family and I was groomed and I was muling heroin. And I really got in the thick of it very fast. And I think it was because, like what you said, I was so beautiful and I was vulnerable and I was everything that they would have wanted. And I was also quite clever, if that makes sense. And I don't want to glorify anything, like, by no means, you know. But I also have empathy for the child that I was, because when I was being sentenced in the end, like, I think they lost sight of that I was a child, like, you know, because I was so kind of, I had grown up so fast in those few years, you know. And so, you know, I got into that family, and by the age of 15, I think it was 15 actually, that I was caught with the heroin. And it was my 17th birthday was in November, and I was sentenced to 4.5 years in December. And that 4.5 years had like an 18 month review on it. So it meant that I had to spend the whole 18 months in the prison, you know, before the judge seen me again. And he allowed me to, yeah. And it was like, it's called the Annex. Like, okay. So it was the old jail. Like, so it was D1, D2 and D3 was St. Patrick's, and the other side of the yard was St. Patrick's. So effectively it was just like Mount Joy, you know, the women's version of Mount Joy. And I always remember, I'll never forget, you know, Catherine Comfort was her name at the time. I don't know whether it's all right to say, was the governor. At the time, and I remember when I went in, because you had to see the governor when you came in, and she said, we have to get this child out of here, because she wasn't, I don't know if it was like a liability, but I was also a heroin addict, so I think there was an issue with medicating me as well, like, you know. So it was, and the ACO said to her, we can't, there's a review on her. So they couldn't put me anywhere. They couldn't even put me to Oberstown because of this review was to Mountjoy, you know. So I'll never forget it, you know. I remember I was that sick and I was that thin that when I came out of the reception, you go through the reception when you're coming into the prison, and they give you a shower and they give you a change of clothes and stuff like that. And I was walking and they went to give me the tray, you know, with your teapot and a plate and stuff like that. And I genuinely, I was that young that I hadn't really even been in them situations where you'd go out for dinner, where you'd have to hold this tray, like, and I could hear all the women shouting, you know, all roaring and shouting. And as bad of a life that I had been through, all the stuff that I had been through, I was still very fragile. Like, I was still, like, you know, kind of, I was a real nervous child,
you know.
Yeah, you know. And I remember shaking, carrying the tray down the landing, and I felt like it was just going to fall, and I was going to fall, you know. But, you know, because you can hear all these women, you just want to get up, and getting up that landing just felt like forever, you know. And then I remember when they opened the door then to let you out after having the tea and stuff like that. And I remember going, I can't go out. Like, I was so afraid, you know. But when I got out into the landing, like, everybody knew me because they would have known me from town and stuff like that. And it was grand, you know. But, you know, I don't know. Like, it was just, I think I was so young and I was so sick that a lot of it just kind of went over my head, you know, that way. I don't think it really hit me.
And in the sentencing, like, did the judge, he or she just didn't take in the fact you're a child?
Well, in fairness, you know, when I look back now, and I will say, they did send me to Coolmine. And I escaped from Coolmine. Like, as I said, just that wildness, that madness, you know. And when years ago, like, when you went to these kind of places, like, they didn't detox you or medicate you. And I know now today, you know, the more I've learned about addiction, in those withdrawals, I'm just, like, crazy to get, you know, like, it's like a magnetic pull for me to go get that again. And that's all it was. And that was apparently my chance, and I blew it.
Okay.
you know. Mm-hmm. So I will say that's in fairness to them, you know, that kind of way. And it wasn't back then, it really wasn't like it is today, you know. But Rebecca, when I think back and I look back on it and I know what I know today, that sentence saved my life. It really saved my life. So I think even back then, God had his hand on me, you know, that kind of a way. Like, and I often say that, you know, normal people wouldn't say that the jail saved their life, but it really did. So it just gave me that break away from the madness. I wouldn't have said I would have got another year with the rate at the rate that I was really? Going and with the people that I was with, you know, that way. It was a really, really dangerous life that I was living.
You would have been dead, would you?
Yeah, I would say so, because I was so young and vulnerable. Something would have happened to me, you know.
And then how, when you got out at the time, how many years did you do in the end?
I done the year and a half, the 18 months in the end. So I thrived in prison. Like I done me leaving cert. I done loads of courses. At the time there was like these Goshka awards and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I done all that. Do you remember
yeah,
that?
Goshka.
Yeah. I think I done one of them for clean urines.
Oh, really? I remember them. Jesus, yeah. Mad actually.
Yeah.
And did you get off the heroin in jail?
Yeah, I got off it in prison because Rebecca, the only way that you could take it in prison is intravenously, and I just wouldn't do it, you know. It was just like, you know yourself what would have happened using in there, you know. And I remember the detox was horrific, like absolutely horrific, because I was coming off everything, you know, absolutely. And because of the way I was, like, I was taking really large amounts of heroin, you know, and I didn't really realise, and I didn't know the extent of my addiction and my illness itself, you know, that way, until I went in there. I remember I had detoxed, and the man who ran the gym really looked after me. He always kind of like, and I remember him saying, come on in and do a little bit of step aerobics. They used to be trying to take me out of my shell, because they knew I was there for it. I would have been like, back then 18 months was a long period of time, because it was like a revolving door, you know, like. So I mean, I think even, you know, there was women that done really serious crimes that got out after 9 months, and I'd be still there, you know, that kind of a way. And I think for that age, 18 months is an eternity, you know, yeah, that kind
absolutely.
Of way. Yeah, yeah.
And then you got out then, and what was next for you?
So when I was in prison, in the time that I was in prison, because I was such an addict, like, I found running and I found fitness. So I became really obsessive about all them. And I decided I wanted to do a fitness course. And you had this thing called Pathways. So it's for when you come out of prison. Like, I had to go to Pathways to finish another part. I was still, I think, doing some course that I was doing, and I was continuing it on in Pathways. And then Pathways helped me go to college.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was great, you know, and they were very, very supportive. And I think funding and stuff like that as well, like, I help with all that.
And what about your mum and dad at that point? What did, you know, what was that relationship like?
God loved them, you know, when I think about it, really, God loved them. Like, because they were old fashioned, like, they weren't able for it, they weren't used to it. And because I never felt a part of, I never really bonded with them, and they just didn't know what. I think they must have probably thought, like, what did we do? And they didn't do anything, you know. It was me, it was all within me. When I'm like that, and I'm, you know, as we call it, untreated in addiction, I'll keep everyone away from me. You know, I haven't got the capability to love anybody, you know.
That's really bad, isn't it? It's really sad. Like, it's really, really
very
sad.
Very lonely.
And then at what point then did you come to Cyprus?
So I think that was before I actually went to college. It was during during that summer period. Yeah. It was before I went to college that I went to Cyprus. Yeah.
You and Janine came over. And I don't even know where we met, or did I talk to Janine before she came over? I don't know where it came from. I think, if I remember, I spoke to Janine before she came over, and Paul and I were living there already.
Yeah.
And then you guys rocked up, and then we just clicked. We just clicked, and then you were working in that bar in up the top there. And we just looked like we, I was like a long timer over there.
Yeah.
And I was very established, and I had my friends, and they had businesses over there, and we just kind of, I think we just took you in because we just wanted to take you in and just mind you and everything like that. But I know you were having issues over there that we were probably privy to, because as I said to you at the top of this, was that the in my life there's two people that I think about, and we haven't seen, we haven't sat in the same room in 20 years.
No,
20 years. And you, like, you were one person who's always on my mind. Like, you've been always on my mind. So I think we just took you in. But there was issues there as well.
Huge, you know. As I said to you, Rebecca, when I used to stop one thing, if I put down, like, one substance, another thing would come up. And then I'd put that down and another thing would come up and another thing. And each of them was equally as torturous. Like, I really never got a break from it. So if I was trying to, like, I was always trying to stop, like, because when I take something, I take it to the extremity. So I destroy myself when I take something. So I was always trying to stop and trying to stop. But if I was trying to stop, my mind went over and I'd have to go into something else and I wouldn't even notice. And that would have been like the eating disorder and the drink. And then I'd fall in love. I don't know.
That's
hilarious. Like,
that was the biggest worry, I think, because, like, you come down to the pub or come down to the apartment and you were like, I'm in love. And I was like, okay, where is he come from? Two, who is he? And you were like, he's on holidays. It was his brother with him, or it was his friend with him.
I think it was like his mom and dad.
Yeah. They came down to the pub, wasn't it? Or something like that.
He came down, I think, on his own.
Yeah.
And I thought he looked like Prince William. He was like, I was hilarious.
And you were like, you were ready to, he was Russian.
Yeah, he was Russian. And he hadn't got a word of English and I hadn't got a word of Russian. I think he used to say to me, Yati Baliu Blue. He told me, look, that means I love you.
Okay. Oh my God. And we were watching this all unfold in front of us. And I was like, oh shit, what are we going to do here? Like, you know, and you were really and truly in love with him.
Well, you know what my sponsor calls it?
Yeah.
She calls it the two-legged drink.
Right.
It's a two-legged drink. That's what she calls it.
Okay, I get it.
And the two-legged drink means I'll just get a buzz off him.
Yeah.
While I'm trying to, I don't mean that in it. Like, you know, I don't even realise I'm doing it, you know. And it's just like, it's that void, void that you're trying to fill. And you think like, oh, this is it. He's going to fix me. I was going to move to Russia.
You were? Yeah. You were. And we were like, there's rich Russians and then there's poor Russians. I was like, he better be a rich Russian. Do you know what? He's in Ionapit in a 5-star hotel. So we thought he was a rich Russian. But we were like so worried. But then that didn't happen.
Thank God.
Thank God you're still here with us. Like, and then you're like, we had great times. We had really great times over there. And it was very sad to see you leave when you did leave us. Do you know what I mean? And when you came home from there, what happened then?
So when I came home from there, funnily enough, that would have been when I met my son's father then when I came home. And I would have been then just gone heavy into drinking then, you know, like I didn't even know, like, you know, but I always remember thinking, I remember actually it was the wine, Rebecca, you know, the wine, our first date when he asked me out. And I remember thinking the usual, I'm fat, I'm ugly, I can't let me say, do you know what I mean? And I just felt so horrible. And I remember he was like, have a glass of wine. I never drank wine before. Never. It was alien to me, you know, like I'm cool.
Yeah, I know. We never drank it.
Wine.
Yeah.
And he was kind of like, he was a real, like, you know, man about town. He was gorgeous. Mm. Like, I mean, drop dead gorgeous. And like all the women were mad about him. And he was, you know, he had real charisma and everything. And he had worked in Finlayers as a wine specialist and everything, as a sommelier. And he was all mad about the wine. So and anyway, I drinks this glass of wine that he's pushing on me because I'm just like with me nerves, lashing this back on my rim wongs and Renla. Next minute I go into the toilet and all that stuff is gone. All the insecurities are gone, all of that, and I'm lit up and I think, the world is grand. And you know what? I always speak about it and I say it in places, you know, it was like liquid heroin.
Really?
It was just like liquid heroin. And I remember like in me Maz then, it was just a bit, it was like a day, or it was probably the next day after the date, going, I'm going to go up and get a bottle of wine. And I drank it in the bedroom. Like, that's what I'm like. Like, yeah. I just, if I find something that'll, you know, like, give me any type of ease from how I feel, I'll be gone, like, you know. And you're not getting, you know, I have a friend, and my friend, I love her, Monique, you know. And I said to her the other day, like, we're real funny. We've been through so much together. And I love her, you know. And she, I said, Monique, how did you ever get the drink off me? She said, we didn't. It gave you up.
Oh, really?
That's in the end. Yeah, in the end.
And then you went on and had a relationship with him, did you? And
yeah, that was a 10-year relationship, you know, that we had. And unfortunately, he was murdered. That would have been, yeah, it's 12 years ago now, nearly 13 years ago. Yeah.
God.
So that was my first, you know, real kind of, you know, my nan had died and stuff. My nanny died when I was in prison and I was really close to her and I grieved like, you know, but this was like another level of grief because I was grieving for my child. You know, I couldn't believe, like, I had a dad my whole life and then, and my little boy was never going to have that now, you know. And it was just that, really. And I remember just after John was killed, you know, and he used to be saying, where's me daddy? You know, where's me daddy? He used to call him that. He was 3 and a half, just, and it was really sad, like really, really sad, I have to say, you know. It was a really strange, really, really strange time for me, you know. And I think every time with each different trauma, a piece of me was taken each time, you know. And this time it was a huge, you know, it was a huge chunk and it took me a really long time to kind of, I actually don't know if with any of these I ever recovered until this 3 years now. You know, I feel like this last three years, I have recovered. You know, I definitely have recovered, you know. But prior to that, I was never myself. You know, I don't know whether I ever was, you know.
And in the 10 years that you had together, were they good years? Like, were you good?
They were, no, I was never. And you know what, you know, I'm not, you know, I don't like to take his inventory or anything like that. But we were both as mad as each other, which wasn't a good combination. But we were mad about each other, you know, like I was obsessively, as you know, I can get mad about him. And he would have been like that with me as well, you know. And it was a really kind of chaotic relationship, you know, that way. But I do know he was the love of my life anyway. That's the one thing that I know. And I know that I've never met anybody really since then, you know. Not that I know, it's not that I'm shutting myself off or that I ever had, but I just know that that was the big love of my life anyway.
And what was it like for you then when you did have James? Like, what was that like?
Do you know what, Rebecca? It was the happiest time of my life. For once in my life, I had a break from that internal void, you know, and I didn't look externally for something, you know. It was the first real feeling of, like, you know, true love, you know. It was unbelievable. I remember, and because I was often afraid, you know, because I was so cut off, and I knew I was cut off emotionally, you know. I was very cut off emotionally. Until I met John, I had never bonded with anybody. John was my first bond with somebody, you know, and he really got me, and he loved me madness, you know. And he was the first person to ever tell me, you know, that he thought I was beautiful, and he thought I was intelligent and stuff like that. And he used to tell me that, you know. And I remember, you know, kind of after that, then this with James, it was a different love, like a completely different love. And I breastfed, and I was obsessive about having organic food and, you know, all this. And I used to bring him to mother and toddler groups and all up in Renlet and Rathmines, and I loved it. I loved it. I remember I was in fantasy land, you know, that kind of a way.
Just in a bubble.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And when then John died, what was that like then? I know you touched on it a little bit, but what happens next with you? And do you go back down
into the hole? You know, seriously, it was, I remember it was really bad. Like, I was really, really bad. And I do know that I went a little bit insane, you know, in the grief. Like, I was really, really bad. And I you know, what I'll do is I'll go into one or the other, the eating disorder or the addiction, you know, like the substance. But this time I went into the two together.
Okay.
So I wasn't eating and I was drinking bottles of wine, you know, and I remember somebody giving me a sleeping tablet because, like, I hadn't slept in days. I couldn't sleep. And I took the sleeping tablet and I didn't go to sleep that night. And my friend came and she said, I'm just going to take James out for you. It was 2 weeks after John had died. And I'm just going to take James out for you and let you have a bath and get yourself together, clean the house and do whatever. And I said, yeah, you know, and you know, when your mind is so chaotic. And I filled the bath and I got into the bath. And next thing I know, I woke up like nearly underneath the bath. So the sleeping tablet like kicked in when I got into the bath. And I remember jumping out of the bath and shaking uncontrollably. Like, and I remember thinking people would have thought that I killed myself. Like, they would have thought that. And like, and I remember thinking, it was in that moment that I kind of snapped out of it. And I was like, James needs you. Like, he needs you, you know, yeah. This has to stop. Like, and I got some sort of like a little bit of a fight, you know, back in me, you know. And throughout this, Rebecca, you know, I was still always personal training.
Really?
Yeah, but unbelievably so. I was a highly functioning alcoholic, you know, because it wasn't like the heroin, I could really function on it, you know. And I was working in a place in Rat Mines and the man who owned it was lovely. He was really lovely and it was a really exclusive. It was like €65 a session, but I was brilliant at my job. You know, when I learn in the big book, I don't know if people would be familiar with it, and when they describe a real deal alcoholic in the big book, you're brilliant at your job. Like, we're as kind of driven, you know, in the work thing as we are and everything else, you know, that way. So when you find something that you really, really like and it takes you away from yourself slightly, you'll be unbelievably good at that certain thing, you know. So with fitness, I don't know what it was just a natural gift, you know, and personal training was a real gift with me, you know. I think because I was so obsessive about it, I knew everything about it. I knew everything about the body. I knew everything about nutrition, and I kind of like, I had this kind of a way of training people as well, you know. So my boss rang me and he was like, we want you back. Like, and I thought because of the circumstances, you know, that he would have been a little bit, you know, about taking me back. But no, he wanted me back, and that really helped me. It helped me because, you know, I had a purpose to bring in an income to keep James and the house going and everything, you know what I mean? And it just, it helped with the fight, you know, that, you know, getting back on my feet and stuff like that. So it was just a battle. Like, it was just, I thought, you know, the years after John died until I found, until I got clean, were just like a battlefield. They were just chaos, you know. It was really, really dark.
Do you want to tell me a little bit about it?
Yeah, definitely. You know, it was alcohol. Like, I was really in the thick of alcoholic drinking and trying to function. And, you know, so I would, you know, drink, say, 4 bottles of wine. Now, if I was drinking 4 bottles of wine a night, that would be quite normal for me. That was what you were looking at. You know what I mean? That would be me really holding it together. But like, I didn't know that when I put that one drink in, I couldn't stop, you know. So, you know, each morning I'd either wake up on the sofa, or wake up on the kitchen floor, or wake up in the bathroom, or, you know, and I didn't know. And I didn't know what was wrong with me, because my intention was always just to have that one bottle of wine, if not just one glass, you know. But I didn't know that when I put that in, I set off the craving and, you know, I was gone. You know, I'm you know, rip roaring basically, you know. And I remember like going into the rooms of AA, John wouldn't have been long dead. And, you know, I don't know who it was that directed me into the rooms initially. I had met somebody on a night out who was a counsellor, an addiction counsellor, and they rang me the next day and said, you know, like, you're in serious trouble, you know. I remember thinking, how can I be a heroin addict and an alcoholic? I didn't think you could be the two.
Yeah.
I really didn't. I thought that, like, I was that unaware. I really thought you were either one or you were another. I didn't think you could be the two together. And I think I remember saying that to that man, you know, I couldn't be because I was a heroin addict and I'm not anymore.
Yeah.
Like, as if I was miraculously fixed from heroin, you know what I mean? And that doesn't happen either. So, yeah, I remember going into the rooms of AA and...
And can I ask you before you go into that, were people calling you out? Were people saying this to you, or were people enabling you?
No, you know, I think a lot of the time they were waiting for, you know, me to get better after John. You know, they were waiting for me to pick myself back up. And then I remember it kind of got to... It got to about a year or so later and people were kind of going, something still really badly amiss here. And then people started to kind of say stuff and really direct me. And what was happening was I was having, you know, I was going through and I was getting really sick. Like I remember getting mastitis at one stage, and it was, I remember going to the doctor and I had all this swelling here and here, and it was from all of the lymph glands were swollen from the toxins in the wine, and it had given me mastitis. Like, so I was really, really sick, and the doctor put me on a Librium detox, and he was like, this is how women get breast cancer. You know, it's true this way, you know, you'll have to be really careful. And my doctor, Mrenla, was very good. Like, he really, really was. I do often think, like, the poor man, like, he's in this leafy suburb and all of a sudden he has this basket case. Like, you know, our partner's after being murdered, you know. And it just went on, Rebecca, you know. And I remember then I had a really, you know, I had a thing. I went out on a night out one night, and I think because I was so I'd be so unaware, and I'd be so kind of like, I was just all over the place, and then put a drink on top of that, you know, you know, something really traumatic happened, and I you would have got a lot of post-traumatic stress from that, you know. So I think with all the things, it was nearly like being in a war, you know, coming back from some sort of war, and then you're drinking on it, you're drinking on this constantly, you know. And every time I went into the rooms, I couldn't understand how, you know, I'd go in there and, you know, it just didn't happen for me the way it happened.
What are the rooms?
So that would be AA.
Okay.
Yeah. That would be Alcoholics.
Tell me about your first time.
My first time was in Rat Mines, I remember, and I remember just shaking. And when I would, if I didn't drink, you know.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more.
Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I did this sweat, Rebecca, you know, I just, my t-shirt, I remember being soaking wet, and I remember somebody saying to me, take your jacket off, and I couldn't because my t-shirt was so wet, you know, I would be withdrawn, and that would even be with a Librium detox, like I would have been on Librium to kind of get the time, if I got 2 days sober, I made my way down, my doctor directed me down to this AA meeting, and but I remember, and I know now what it was like. I remember my mind racing, just racing in it. And I couldn't really hear what the people were saying. You know, I couldn't really grasp the message that they were trying to get across to me, you know. And unfortunately, like, I was in and out for 10 years. I didn't get it for 10 years. No.
And in the 10 years, did you do any, what's the rehab?
Yeah, I done two. I done a lot of like hospital stints, and then I would have went to Brewery in Limerick. I have to say it was really, really tough, like really tough. Sister Concilios. And I came out, and I'll never forget coming out of there. And I remember feeling like I was on a holiday when I was walking through town. I felt like I was on a holiday because the obsession to drink and use had gone. And I remember looking around Dublin and saying, like, God, I never seen that before. Like, I've lived here for what, 37 years or something, and I haven't seen, like, Trinity College look different, Grafton Street look different. And I remember going up to a meeting that day and saying, I feel like I'm on a holiday, and they were all roaring laughing, like, you know. And it was that, because reality of that situation was, Rebecca, I haven't been clean since I was 14. So I was really, like, when I actually eventually did totally stop, I really was like, I had that arrested development. I was like a 14-year-old, you know, trying to cope with life on life's terms, like, as you'd say, you know. I was really, really immature, like really immature.
And who was looking after James when that was happening?
Sister Karina. So I have a sister, and she's 14 years older than me. God, I'd be lost without her, you know. And she's another one that always loved me and always believed in me, you know. And she saw what you would have seen and what other people would have seen, you know, and she knew, like, and she would have known how much I battled with it, you know. She understood it the way other people wouldn't really. She had a compassion, you know. And I think because she knew me from a really young age, like, she always tells people, you know, about me when I was younger and all. I think she said I always knew there was something amiss, you know, that kind of a way. So she would have took James for me, and she was brilliant, you know, she really, really was, yeah.
And you just said there about compassion. Do you get compassion from people?
Not all the time, you know, because really when I look at my life, you know, I always say on paper, I look like an absolute nightmare, Rebecca. On paper, nobody would go near me if they looked at, you know, and as you know, I am in a book, you know, and that was hence the name change, you know, and I still to this day, I can't get my name out of that. And that in itself doesn't look good either, you know, that way, like, but people who know me know, you know, and that matters to me more. And you know, I love, as you know, I'm a Christian now, and you know, I'll never ever forget. I remember the woman who used to keep coming to my house in the end, when I was totally rock bottom. I came out of that rehab, and unfortunately, it was really mad. The eating disorder came back. And I always say I learned from that then, you know, I don't get long out of one before I'm into the other, because the one gets really torturous and then I'm looking for something else. And I drank again. And when I drank again, it was catastrophic. Like each relapse was a million times worse than the next. But that last relapse was, I mean, chaotic. Like it went, and I remember this little woman, she used to follow me around all the meetings. She was 60, and she was chronic alcoholic back in the day, and she used to follow me around the meetings, and she used to say to me, "You're chronic, you're absolutely chronic, you're going to die. And here I used to be, she'd leave me alone. I couldn't be, can I be? I'm only 40, you know, whatever. I remember she rang me on the phone and I said to her, I drank again. And she told me four things that were going to happen. And all of them happened. You know, she told me that I was going to lose James. I was going to lose my mind. And I was going to, what else was it? Lose my house. And I was going to be killed. I was going to die. And at the end of that 8 month relapse, I was nearly murdered in my flat, you know. And I remember thinking, she was right. She was right about everything. Like she knew this disease, like she knew it inside out. And from her saying that to me that day, I really, really knew and saw the grave nature of what I suffer from, you know, really, really kind of was woke up to it all, you know.
What is it like when you lose your mind? Like,
oh, Rebecca, I tell you, there's been a couple of times along where I've totally lost my mind. One was when I was in the accident. I don't really want to talk too much about that, you know. I lost my mind after that, and I was in this deep post-traumatic stress. And I remember when you lose your mind, Rebecca, like you trying to, I remember the second time that I lost my mind, trying to pull a thought together, like trying to, you know, think of something, even one rational thing, and you can't, like you're just, you know, when people say that rocking back and forward, like you're just in oblivion. And really the only thing that your mind is telling you is, you know, just die. You're not worth anything, you know. I remember my mind used to constantly say, you know, your son is better off without you. He's better off without you. He's better off with Karina. Look what you're doing. You're a scumbag. You're this. You're a bad mother. Although it just constantly, I remember the last rehab that I got to was Sister Concilio's in Atai, Coomera in Atai. And I walked in there and I'll never, ever forget it as long as I live. I'd just been beaten to a pulp and I had this side of my face bashed in. There was a big scar down here with stitches in it. And the nurse Eileen was like, you wouldn't treat a dog like this. You wouldn't treat a dog like this, you know. And I remember going into the sitting room and I couldn't even think, you know, I couldn't. She gave me painkillers, she gave me Librium, and I got no relief from anything. And I remember knowing in that moment, what am I going to do? Like, I thought if I had took that tablet, you know, I'd be able to stop shaking, or I'd be able to maybe think, or I'd be able to, and I couldn't, you know. And I remember my mind saying to me, just kill yourself tonight. Just kill yourself tonight. Just end this all. Look at what you've done. This is the way losing your mind, this is what it's like. This is what the tape is like when you lose your mind, you know. And it was just like, it was going and going, and it was getting louder and louder and louder. And I remember jumping up off that sofa and running down the hall. I wanted to make a phone call, I was standing at the thing. I wanted to make a phone call. I think I had said to somebody, I want to make a phone call. And that phone call, like, I don't really like saying it like this because my mind was gone. And this is just what I'm describing. This is not me rationally. I would never do this on my child rationally. But I remember saying, I'll just ring James and tell him that I love him before I die. Because my mind is telling me, you know, you're better off and just do it. And you know, it's nothing rational. There's no rationality in it. And there was this girl on the phone. And I remember just going, like, I couldn't even wait. You know, when you've no patience and you've no... And I hadn't even... I was too weak. I couldn't even kneel down or I couldn't even sit. And I remember just jumping up and running into the oratory. There was a little oratory at the reception. And I remember just dropping to my knees and roaring, crying and looking up at the cross and just saying, God, please, please. And I remember just constantly screaming, me little boy, me little boy. Now, he was 11, but that's what I always called him. And I was rocking back and forward in there for a really long time. And I must have been just sobbing uncontrollably. And I remember people kind of coming to the door, but just closing the door back and just letting me, you know, and I remember, like, that was the morning that I went through that into that centre in the morning time. And I came out of that oratory and it was tea time, you know, so I must have been in there for hours. But I remember going in for the tea and sitting down and I could kind of talk, like, you know, a girl says to me, you know, where are you from? And are you all right? And are you going to go down for your medication? And I could talk to her, you know. And I remember just walking and I knew something had happened. Do you know, and I just knew something had happened, Rebecca. And it was like God took that from me. He definitely took the suicide thing from me. And he definitely took, you know, some sort of a thing. He filled me with something that night. And I remember going on a walk around that rehab and looking up at the sky and saying, I don't know what this is, but I want to hold on to it. I'll do whatever it takes. And I remember in that rehab, like, I had been in the one the year before, and I remember just going, right, I know this program. I'm going to just do this. I'm going to do it. I don't care. I'm just going to do this. And I just done everything. I just gave it me all, you know, I really, really gave it me all. And I remember just knowing that I'm going to go back. I'm going to get a sponsor. I had a game plan and I really had a fight and a drive. And I really was like, I'm not letting this beat me again. I'm not letting this take everything from me again, you know.
it's just everything that, like, me and everyone else probably worried about for you.
Yeah.
And hearing you say it is, like, powerful. It's really it's hitting me hard, like, listening to you say it. You talked about earlier on, you talked about your steps. Can we talk a little bit about your steps and how that works?
So when I would have went back into the rooms then, and I got a sponsor, and I knew this was what they all done to get well. And I knew, I always talk about it, you know, I remember I used to look at all the women in the meetings, you know, and how they held themselves and how they spoke. And I remember them speaking and they'd be talking about what it was like, you know, and it wasn't what they're like now. Do you know what I mean? And I remember thinking, like, you know, I want to be like that. Do you know what I mean? I want to have a nice handbag and not be sweating and, you know, that kind of way. And I remember this one particular woman, you know, and I kept thinking of her when I was in rehab because I used to love hearing her share and I loved her peace and I loved the way she was. She just had this aura, this glow. And I asked her to bring me through the steps when I got home. I nearly put her in a headlock outside of me, you know. And we were like worlds apart. Like, I mean, worlds apart. Like, she was... I don't want to really, like, get into too much, you know, that kind of way. Like, I don't want to break anyone's anonymity in any way, but she was an absolute lady. Like, she really, really was. And she taught me so much. Like, she taught me so much. But, like, I remember I'd be telling her things. And I remember, like, God love her. Like, she'd be just in shock, you know. And I think it kind of, like, at times, like, it would have been... it would have been quite sad for her as well, do you know, that way, like, because you have to really go really deep in it, in especially in your fourth step, you know. So there was stuff, really traumatic stuff there, you know. But she done an amazing job. She really done an amazing job. And I've gone on now since then and worked with different women at different times, you know, and each woman has taught me something new, you know. But then I also do my church as well, as you know. Yeah, so...
I'm going to talk about that because, you know, I want to talk about that. Just on the fourth step, it's shame. Talk a little bit about shame.
Yeah, it's all like, you know... It's just a searching and fearless moral inventory of yourself. Like, so it really just gets rid of all that junk that we hold on to, you know, all of the secrets and all of the things that we swore that we'd never tell anybody, you know. Once you get rid of that, Rebecca, you allow the spirit to come in. You know, because until then, as I said to you, you know, when you speak to people that are full of all that, they're full of all that shame and guilt, and they're beating themselves up. You can't really get through to them, you know, because they're so guarded, you know, and that's the way I would have been. I would have been so guarded. I really, really held everyone at arm's length because I didn't really want them to ever know anything about me. And I really thought as well, I think my 10 years in and out of them rooms before this was because I didn't want anyone to know. I wanted to keep all this to myself, you know. I remember thinking when people would be sharing about all of that stuff, I remember always thinking, I could never tell anyone. Mm-hmm. I could never tell anybody, you know. And you know what? When I really got down and I did do it in the end, you know what? I got that desperate in the end that I would have done anything to stay away from it, you know. Anything that would have kept me away from going back to that life, I'd have done it. If you'd have told me, like, Rebecca, you know, you're going to have to, you know, stand on your head for a year, I'd have done it just to stay away, you know, because it had been that chaotic and that painful that I couldn't go back there, you know.
And something that I talked about with Ruth previously was that she had to say goodbye to people. But in your case, were you going to... Oh no, you're wrong.
Ranger. Like, I really was. I know that sounds funny to anybody, but I was always like that. I was always really like that, you know. It would have been kind of like me sitting room was where I drank and where I done. And you know what? It was really funny. Like, a lot of people, not till really the very end, would have said, you know, because I trained and I done and I was quite, you know, clever in regards to like nutrition and training. So I counteracted things all the time. And I remember like doing research when I was like the total, like, you know, in the thick of it with the drinking. And I remember doing research and doing this. She was a New York nutritionist and she was a realist. And she made sure that you could drink while you were doing this. And it was like, it was all about counteracting. I done all this kind of stuff. And then I'd be, you know, spirulina or do anything. Like, I would run miles or I'd do this or I'd do that. Anything not to kind of have to stop what I did. I wasn't letting go of that substance, you know, because that was the only kind of comfort I had.
And then, as we said, that was it in the moment that you were in that oratory? Yeah, I know that's terrible. Yeah. Was it in that moment that you found God and did that continue?
Yeah. But when I look back, Rebecca, funnily enough, I always cried out to God. And I do remember feeling his presence when I was in prison, when I was detoxing in prison. I remember feeling something. And I know now that that was God because I felt that again, obviously, you know. But I didn't know that back then, you know. You know, so when the presence of God came in and I felt that peace and that love, I remember it was really funny when I was down there in the tie and you'd have these girls and they'd look after the group I remember going in, they were doing the rosary, and I was really serious about kind of, I wanted to keep going back in and talking to God in that oratory because of that peace that I got and because I knew something had happened in there. And I remember they were doing the rosary, and I don't mean to sound awful, but it was like, I could just say like they were herding cattle.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't mean that in a thin way. But it was like, I was like, Celia, I said, I have to go in. I have to go back into the oratory. So when they're doing the rosary, can I go in and talk to God? And I remember I looked at me going, no, her mind is still gone.
Yeah, like,
And she gave me that grace. So when they used to go in there, I'd go down and you know, like I was kind of having that little bit of I just wanted to keep that connection, and I didn't even know anything about it. It was just that peace and that solace that I found, like I didn't want to lose it, you know, that way. Because I think in my life, I'd say that time in prison, I remember losing that peace, and I didn't want to lose that again. So it was basically, that was it.
And then did you find a church and find a community, or how did it work for you?
But you know what was really funny was, actually, talk about God, actually was there the whole time, because when I was rock bottom in my flat, it was literally like a squat, you know, and the door was broken and it was really, really bad, like, you know. And this woman used to keep knocking up to the flat, and she was from the church, she was from St. Mark's Church. Her name is Katie, and she was like me, like she was well out, she was back before she was saved, like. And so she, it was like God knew who to use, because she was well able to come into the flat, and she was well able to. And I remember her coming into the flat one day, and she thought I was actually getting broken into, because I was actually coming in, leaving me handbag on the balcony, going in and leaving the front door open and going into bed and just, you know, going to sleep, and woke up the next morning, just went straight to get the wine. And I didn't, the door and the handbag were still, one was open and the other was out. And I remember Katie coming in, and I was gone. Like, I was really insane at that time. And she said to me, will you give your life to the Lord? You know, and I remember saying to her, Katie, even that won't stop me. Because anything that I had tried, it stopped. And this is real poignant. She said to me in that moment, she said, he'll kill the old you. God will kill the old you. And I said, right, go on then. You know what I mean? Yeah. And it was a real thing like that. But I do remember in that moment closing my eyes and hoping. And I remember saying, he's mad about you. He loves you. He's mad about you, about God, right? And I remember thinking, you know, why would he, you know, the way and everything that was gone. And I gave my life to the Lord that day. And 2 days, I think, or a day later, I was nearly murdered in the flat. And I got to the treatment centre straight after that and found God in the oratory straight after that. So it was all it was all predestined, I think, by God, you know. And it really, it took for all of that for me never to go back there, you know.
And is she still in your life?
Yeah, I love her. I have this kind of, like, she calls me our spiritual daughter, you know. So and she couldn't, I think she couldn't believe when I came out of rehab, I said, Katie, I was telling her everything I said, and she was roaring laughing when I was telling her about the rosary and going into God. She was roaring laughing, you know, because she definitely knew that something had happened, you know. And I said to her, Katie, I got a Bible and I found Psalm 18, and she was like, she couldn't believe it, like I was reading the Bible. So the veil had been lifted and I understood Psalm 18, and in Psalm 18 says, I delivered you from a violent man and I stood you on the rock of salvation, you know. And it says the ropes of death entangled you. And that Psalm spoke to me, like it just really, really spoke to me. And I always think that's like, it's the Psalm of David, you know, when he's, you know, in battle and stuff like that. And that's what I was in addiction, was a total battle, you know. Hello.
It's mad because a few of my friends would know that I'm quite religious. And then when people meet me, they're like, how are you religious? How are you in any way religious? And I was like, just because I say fuck a lot, or you know, because I course a lot, or did especially people like it, not, not from Ireland, in the UK. And my friends be like to me, "You're such a holy Joe sometimes." But I do feel personally, we'll get a little bit into it, and Paul, I know, doesn't like me getting into it, but I do feel like God does save. That's how I feel about it.
And you know what? I did feel him as well after John died, you know, and, do you know what it always says? Like, you won't blow out a dimly lit light, you know? So if your light is going out, you won't blow it out. He'll revive that light, you know? Jesus came to heal the brokenhearted and bind up their wounds, you know, and that's what I feel, you know, like people who are, you know, it's brokenhearted and crushed in spirit. And that's what I was. I always speak about my addiction, my powerlessness, as being brokenhearted, because I was brokenhearted that I couldn't stop Rebecca. I was absolutely brokenhearted. I thought, you know, do I not love my son enough to be able to stop this? And I didn't know that it was bigger than me. Do you know, it was bigger than me, and nothing that I done could conquer that, you know. And God is the only one who could take that away, you know. My power can't do it. Your power can't do it. Nowhere, because believe me, I'd been everywhere throughout the years. Like, I'd been hospitals, psychiatric wards, prisons. I'd been to rehabs. Nothing conquered my addiction until God came in. You know,
what do you say to people who don't believe that?
You know, like I let people be, you know, I really do. I let people be, because God is love, and I love everybody. I genuinely do. You know, God is love. And do you know what's really funny, Rebecca? Did you know that when we were in Cyprus, I got love tattooed on
you
the back
of my neck? Oh my God. Yeah. And I just remember that now.
Yeah. And I always speak about it. Yeah. And that's all that God is. And all God asks me to do is pour love on people. So whether you believe or you don't believe, I love you regardless, and Jesus loves you regardless. Like, that's the bottom line, you know. You know, he came here not to save the godly, he came to save the sinners. Mm. You know, like, when you say save the wretch like me, like, I was a wretch. I just say, God, I'd say you had some crack running after me.
And it's because I do think even then, in Cyprus, you loved everybody. You just loved. You just, that's the thing about you. You just had this love.
Yeah.
And
childlike.
And I think that's why we connected so much, because I do feel like I feel now as well, and I said this before a different podcast, with a girl who is a firm believer in God, and I did say that we do have people, and this is nothing against it, because I've done it myself, like, you know, the sea swimming and you know, going out to be back with nature, because they're trying to find something.
Yeah.
And I in my head, I'm like, God's there.
Yeah. He's all around us. He's all there, around us.
You know?
He's all around us. And you know what I always say to people, like, do you know what? If you came from what I came from and you had the mind that I have, and then you got saved like this, you know, I would be unbelievably selfish if I didn't tell you about Jesus. Like, I really, really would, you know. There's a pastor who speaks about it, and he says, you know, he had this dream, like, God comes to us in dreams, and he had this dream that when he was at the gates of heaven, you know, and it was you know, where we're being kind of like spoke to by God, and he turned around and his friend said to him, "Why didn't you tell me? Like, why didn't you tell me, you know?" And it's just that, you know, but there is a huge revival. There's a huge revival since the lockdown, you know. And, you know, I found a lovely pastor, Life Changers Church in America. And I have all my friends, all of them, you know, on Twitter. And, you know, he speaks about that, you know, the revival. And he kind of, like, the lockdown hit, the churches hit more homes in the lockdown. They closed the churches, but we got to our home more so then, you know, and onto the internet a lot more. Yeah.
Because I did find comfort. And again, I don't think many people would believe it, but I did find comfort because St. Francis down in Prizewood went onto the webcam.
Ah, yeah.
And I would come on, the three of them would be there. And Paul came in one day and he was like, What are you watching? And I was like, oh, I love him. And he's a brother, he's not a father.
Yeah.
And he just has the chats and he plays a few songs and all. And I was like, I just find comfort in that. I find peace in it.
Rebecca, that reminds me, like when I was in prison, so on a Sunday morning, Father Healy used to come in on a Sunday morning, right? And I used to help him set up the altar on the top of the land. And it was always, when I think about it now, and I used to say, Father Healy, do you think that the nuns would let me join the convent? Because I'd have a bad week and I'd want to get out. I think he used to be, you know, getting the laugh with me. And he used to say, oh no, go out and ask them, you know.
It's mad, but it's mad how it is a full circle moment in your life. Now tell me about the personal training. Now you're flying.
Rebecca, do you know what I think it always was? Like, obviously the addiction always got in the way, and my mind always got in the way, so I never believed it, you know, that I actually was as good as I was, or I had what I had, or I never, you know, like nurtured the gift, or, you know, I never even really properly put myself out there, you know, because I always felt less than, you know. So I got saved, and then I you know, done the work on myself and everything. And I remember the last woman, she said to me, you know, like, you're actually very intelligent. Why have you never, you know, kind of nurtured this or gone and done? She's like, why don't you just open your own business? Because I'd be doing like little classes here and there and, you know, training people in my house and everything. And I remember just going then and finding out about this back to work enterprise scheme and going on and getting accepted for doing the business course. I'm really loving that course. Like, I love learning and I love courses and stuff. And I done that business course and I got all fired up, and I opened up Paloma Fit. And that, like, I literally opened the doors and I didn't even get time to breathe. I was just packed out, you know, because I have this lovely way of training, that lightweight high rep system, but I also kind of like just have a way about it, like the classes flow. I always listen to a podcast, Joe Rogan's podcast, and he says, like, if the class doesn't flow, you're in trouble, you know. And I think that's the beauty of my training, is it always flows. Like, there's a lovely flow to it, you know. So yeah, there's the women that love it, you know, Erin, our mom, and all they, Margaret loves me training. And you know, meeting Margaret and Erin back, I opened the business and they came in. They had met me in the lives in the lockdown. Margaret just encountered my training through the lives, she gave me great confidence, you know, really. Like, I often say, I think that's where Connor gets it from, you know, definitely. I don't think I know. And she was great. She, like, really helped with my self-esteem when I was forced, like, getting into the business. She helped me to believe in myself, you know. I think because she loved me training so much, and I was just, like, I think God puts people like that in your path, like, you know.
Definitely. Because I do think that, again, Paul, but this Paul, he's just not religiously, he just say it to me, stuff to me, but I just think God put an awful lot of things and put the podcast into my life that I get to meet these amazing people.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Can I ask you now, are you still a Lone Ranger?
Yes, I am indeed. And you know what? It's just got to a stage where now I'm just going to wait for a Christian husband. Like, that's basically it. That's what I just decided. I decided that, you know, I got quite serious about everything in the end, you know, because even with the likes of relationships, I get into a lot of pain with that as well. And I just said, you know what, I just want to focus 110% on my son, my home, the business and stuff like that. And if God has a man for me, I mean, he'll be the best man. So be worth the wait, you know, that way. So that's what I decided to do. And do you know what? It's been my happiest time. It's been my happiest time, you know.
I've seen it. And I sent you, and I reached out to you, and I said this at the start, like, I just, like, throughout this whole thing, like, I can't even talk about you because I'm just so happy for you. I'm just I can see it, and you haven't changed. You haven't changed at all. Like, and I'm so happy to see you doing so well. Tell me about James. How is he?
He's great, yeah. Mm. He's in St. David's. It's really funny because that's where I would have went to school, in Artain as well. And he's brilliant with art, very good with art. And Karina would have nurtured that in him because she's an interior designer. Okay. She's an artist. So she would have like taught him how to draw and stuff like that. There was a phase where he was mad into the graffiti and stuff like that, you know, and doing things. Yeah. So he goes through little phases, but he's lovely. He's really lovely. Like, he's, you know what, I'll never forget John where he is because he's the image of his dad. Yeah. And it's really funny. Like, he's every mannerism of him and everything, you know. He'd be like, he eats like him, he sits like him, and he's, you know, he's really like looking at him, you know.
Do you talk to John now? Do you talk to him in through God, or do you know what?
I know I'm going to meet him again. That's the lovely thing about what I know about God, is that I'm going to meet him again. So that's a really lovely thing about it, you know. And you know, I think, you know, I talk to God, and it's God who will interpret there, you know. And I know God, John, is at peace. You know, because, you know, I know it wasn't, you know, wasn't his time and stuff like that. But I know now, do you ever feel like somebody's at peace? And he's definitely in heaven, you know, and you know, we're going to meet again.
And then what does the future hold for you? Where are you?
So where I'm at right now is real exciting because I'm doing another course now, and it's a trainer course, a QQI level 6. So I'm in the middle of doing a project now to create my own fitness course.
Brilliant.
To be able to teach. And really my dream with that is, you know, like, I was a delinquent and I want to do that. I want to teach kids that are struggling, or kids that are in trouble, or kids, like, I mean, if they've just come out of Oberstown, do you know, to catch them then and teach them about fitness. Because in the reality of all what I spoke about tonight, the one cog that saved me all through this was fitness. You know, it was where I always got my fight back, and where I always kind of, it really helped me to survive, you know, and it gave me some purpose in life, and it gave me the will to live even at times, you know, that way. And I'd love to pass on that to you know, to, and, you know, I really just want to go into, I don't really have a thing of making, I'm not, you know, money is not my king. Jesus is my king, you know. And really all I want to do is, you know, obviously, yeah, I would love to get security for me and James, but really the thing that I want to do is, you know, help others and not leave the fitness industry without having made me mark. And I think really the one mark that you'd make is leaving this fitness course and then passing it on for other people to teach them, because I have this way of teaching that I would like to pass on, you know. Yeah.
And on that note, Paloma, we leave it there.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
Thank you.
I know people are going to be like, oh my God, she's in love with her, but I am in love with you. Do you know what I mean?
I'm in love with you.
Yeah,
too.
It's just like, I'm just so happy that we've reconnected like this.
Brilliant.
And I know that loads of people are going to get something from this. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Rebecca.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.